neutral and it's very close to ground.
I can see how Y would be favored, with the center of the Y being ground, because if your raw source of power ran ungrounded, somebody who is a customer could make the mistake of pumping AC or DC voltage back into the system and raise the whole thing far above or far below ground. So I suspect that the majority of wiring for safety reasons happens to be Y. Is that roughly true, Glenn?
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. Especially ground operations are almost always, United States at least anyway, won't have the neutral Y connection. As a delta, where do you find delta three phase? You find it in aircraft, aviation, you find it in military applications, mobile applications where three phase AC is required, and in most of those apps, they're usually 400 hertz.
If I had a source of power on an aircraft, which is wired as delta, where is ground in that system, Glenn? Go ahead.
About 4,000 volts of insulation difference. A lot of spacing. That's generally how it's done, Vic. They don't like to run any currents in fuselages.
So I think you're saying with delta wiring on an aircraft, between the source of energy and the user of the energy, there is no ground leg on the frame of that aircraft. The wiring, you consider the wiring complete between the generator and user, and there is no ground, is what I think you're saying.
Right on, Dick, that's exactly it. And you'll see that also in a lot of mobile mobile applications that are especially aviation and also on shipboard. A lot of times, subsystems really, if they're run from separate generators or separate AC power like that, they really don't like having those systems attached to have currents either in the base of the ship or in the aircraft.
John, you've worked on some very high power ship power supplies. Do they tend to be wired in delta, KC2WGB, KGIW?
Yeah, all of the ships that come in and we plug into and power up are all three-phase delta, 480, 600 amperes per joy plug, and there's usually like four joy plugs. Yep.
Okay, so you guys use 600 amperes. I did a calculation earlier with Paul that the number of kilowatts and the voltage for the solar panels on the International Space Station calculated to be 600 amperes. I thought that number was crazy. Obvious by your ship experience, 600 amps is real, isn't it, John?
Oh, absolutely. And then on board ship, they would use whatever transformers they wanted to develop anything, any voltage they wanted to. But what was fed to the ship was all three-phase. Beautiful stuff.
If I'm feeding 600 amperes through wires, what gauge is that wire? And if I'm plugging into a 600 ampere capable system, what kind of a plug is that that's conducting 600 amperes? What does it look like? Over to you, John.
I think it's called a joy plug, and it's shore power, and it's a round receptacle about 8 inches in diameter, and your cable plugs into it. Now, the interesting part is, cable that's in there, there's three of them, let's say they're 500,000s and it's 400 amps. Okay, well, how it makes the connection in the joy plug is there are receptacle pins, maybe 10 of them on each connector, that when you make that joy plug, those little pins make contact with the output connector that you're connecting to, and those pins are movable, and they put pressure on there to hold that. They don't just have one like a bayonet fitting or a sleeve like a welder has that you plug in. They're multiple pin connectors, and they work extremely well, very durable.
Okay, the slang in your industry is to call it a joy collector, a joy connector. If I wanted to see a photograph on an internet site of a joy connector, joy plug, is there a mill standard? Where would I go? If I I simply Google the word joy plug, am I going to come up with the right object? Were they going to show me a photograph of this thing, John? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Put in there 400 amp joy plug marine, and you should be able to get a beautiful picture of it. That's the manufacturer.
Okay, I'm about to go do that. And this joy plug, how many contacts are on the male and how many contacts are on the female when they come together?
I believe there were 10 pins on each connector. There's three connectors, so it would be a total of 30 pins. High pressure point pins, rubber weatherproof seal. When that thing is connected and you hit the clamp and you pull it down, it could rain like hell. There's no water going in that joy plug. They work beautifully. And when you look at the plug, the connectors, you'll see the ring of connectors are set up in a delta fashion.
This is AC2IS with a question for next week.
Oh, that's good. We need questions. Go ahead, Bill.
Go ahead, Bill.
So a friend of mine, Jesse, was at HRU today, and he brought a couple cloverleaf antennas that he made. He got what looks like a very professionally made antenna that he made himself. But he's not familiar, he found plans on the internet, he made his antennas, they seem to work well. But he doesn't really know anything about the theory of why they're working or how they work. And I had a question, if you look at a cloverleaf antenna, is that an example more of, say, if it's a three-leaf antenna, is that three loop antennas that are pieced together? Or is that a very short helical antenna, or is it sort of both, AC2IS?
I think you could call it three loop antennas. They're all fed in phase. Some of them are made as a three-leaf clover, and some of them are a four-leaf clover. In the old days, people used to mount that thing parallel to the ground on a mast that hung from the bumper of an automobile. So it has been used as a horizontally polarized omnidirectional automobile antenna. But I think you could call it three loops that come together in phase at the center feed point, and they're resonant at the operating frequency. That's a partial explanation now, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Jesse was listening in on the first part of TechNet today when you guys were talking about oil burners. He's had his ham radio license for a while, but he's never actually keyed up. He's never actually been on the air. He has an HT, I believe he's in range of a repeater. But next week, maybe you could give him a shout out and see if he's on the air and see if you can encourage him to actually ask these questions himself. He is attempting to design his own unidirectional coupler as well, a PC-14 instruction. I think he's got sort of a first attempt at a design. He might have questions about that as well. AC2IS.
Yeah, give me his name and his call letters.
Jesse Bushman. But I don't know what his call letters are. AC2IS.
He's a member of your group?
I'm sorry. That was a question for me. AC2IS.
Is he a member of your group, Bill?
Yes, Jesse is a member of Island Life.
WHORY, just listening. The guy that's just transferring on high band, it sounds like they're off frequency a little bit. I mean, maybe it's just me, but it sounds like your voice peaks are distorted, like you're off frequency. Are you checking your frequency?
AC2IS tuned to 147, was it 380? Transmitting on 147.980, AC2IS.
There's the problem. It's supposed to be 375.
AC2IS. How am I?
Much more better.
So, Dick, do you think that by next week we'll have all these questions answered, or not?
Is there any doubt in your mind? How can there be any doubt in your mind, Joe, that we're going to answer everything next week?
Oh, I don't know. Some of these people come and keep on coming on the tech deck with these real stumpers, you know?
We've always had stumpers. By the way, I have no trouble listening to you on the 375 machine.
Beaming on that, so that's fine. I was going to make a comment earlier. I heard Paul talking on, when Paul was talking on repeater, I don't know why he was on that frequency, but I heard him on the input clear, and when he was transmitting through the repeater, it had all sorts of desets and stuff that was being retransmitted through the whole system. It sounded like, you know, garbage. Are you still there, Dick? Did you go, sign off?
Had to get set up with the idiot.
Oh, is that what's going on? Somebody's, doing that stuff again?
Yeah, we got the touchstone guy on.
Oh, well. John, you seem to know something about oil burners, actually, because of your, you know, piping in earlier about the question I answered. Is that correct? You got some sort of background on that, or just general knowledge?
The knowledge just came from being on site when the testing was being done on the factory installations and comparing it to the factory specs, and they were really examining them very closely. But, yeah, a lot of expensive equipment, though.
It's kind of interesting how somebody can take the measurement of flue gases, for example, and heat, compile that all, and apparently calculate your efficiency of your, you know, of your system, you know, locally by itself, not your whole, I mean, to be a boiler, not your whole system. That's a different thing all by itself. But it's interesting how that that can apparently be done, because there are measurement devices that go for about $1,000 that measure this kind of stuff. You stick a tube in the stack and measures your air, your temperature, and other components it's sensing, and the other one goes on the other side by your port, and you can do like a draft test to see if your draft is set correctly as far as vacuum or number of, or, you know, very interesting, this kind of stuff. But it takes a lot of money to buy this stuff, you know. It's like you just. Not too many people can buy all these instruments, so I figured I'd ask a question to see if there's a cheap way out.
Yeah, right. Never a cheap way out. But what I found was interesting was as the soot collects on the heat exchanger, problem is the temperature of the stack goes up because it's not being absorbed by the heat exchanger. It has to go somewhere. So it does go up the stack. But when it's cleaned, that's what they were measuring. The fact that soot collected on the heat exchanger, they would be looking at the elevation of temperature of the liquid that was used for the hydronic system, and they would watch that rise. And if it wasn't right, they knew something was wrong with that heat exchanger or the flame itself. So, I mean, these guys were really into this stuff. It was interesting to watch.
Yeah, I guess it is. I guess somebody who's really a professional, been doing it for a long time, you can kind of just stand there and watch what you do, and maybe even learn something, or a thing or two or three. It is kind of neat. As simple as the device happens to be within itself, it's interesting to know how the whole thing works.
Yeah, when they do it, they have so many probes. They're looking at the temperature in the fire chamber, and that, of course, has to be something that doesn't leak heat. They look at the radiant heat coming off of the unit, whether the insulation is functioning properly. I mean, they really do a good job, the factory people. But, you know, what are they looking at? A 3% variant, something like that on new equipment? The older equipment, and like Eric had mentioned, once you get the burner at the maximum efficiency you can get, then the only thing you can do now is improve the structure and the leaks that you have, drafts and stuff like that.
VH1RY. Oh, yeah, you're right on that. You're right. And actually, I saw a TV program one time on actually how they do that. Very interesting method of what they do. They have this system where they put a plastic, they open up your front door, and they put this plastic thing in place where that's got some fans. So it's totally sealing the front door except for a place where, like, you know, it can push air out of your house at that one particular point. And then once they do that, they get enough air moving, they can actually take a something resembles either a flame, like these things you'd light a candle with, whatever, walk around your house, and look at the air, and that's where the air is coming back into your house from. They can actually find your address that way. I thought that's a pretty cool way of doing things.
You're absolutely right. They're called door blowers. And if you look them up on eBay, they sell them there. You can't believe how expensive those things are. But, you know, they provide a certain amount of CFM, and it's a very measured thing. But you could do the same thing with a couple of muffin fans. But, boy, that's an expensive article. And it does. It blocks the door opening, but has an aperture for the fans to move a certain specific amount of air. And then they go around the house checking all that out with, well, a lot of different instruments. And they also have the infrared cameras that they examine the structure with. That's an interesting thing, too. They can tell exactly where the most of the heat is escaping, either from windows or some opening that you may have in the structure. Good stuff.
Yeah, these people use something called, I think the term is called the manometer, that measures a differential in air pressure. One part goes outside, one part stays inside your house. They can measure the difference of, you know, a couple of inches in, or even smaller than that, differential in pressure between, you know, outside to inside. And I guess if your house is not really sealed up that well, it doesn't develop that much of a so-called negative pressure compared to the outside, since it's pushing the air out. So, yeah, it all is neat stuff. You know, all it takes is the money to buy all this fancy stuff.
AC2WGB. Joe, in some of the installations we did, we had plate rooms and other type of rooms that had some harsh chemicals in it. Now, imagine this. You're air conditioning this room, which has a lot of heat-producing items, and you're also in the winter heating the room. But we had to supply 80% fresh air. Can you imagine when it's 20 degrees out, how hard that system had to work? Or in the summertime when it's like 90 degrees up and we're 80% fresh air coming in, how the air conditioner had to work? It was crazy.
Wow. That sounds like some sort of real complicated system to be able to do that. And you're right. It is working pretty hard to overcome all those different, environmental challenges like that. And that's one of those things. But I guess, if you got a certain environment, you have to condition a certain way. That's what you have to do. Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, it sounds like you've been around a while. You know a lot about it, a lot of different things. It's kind of interesting. I didn't know about it. I just listened to the conversation before. I didn't even know that about the ships. They call them plugs, joy plugs. That's very just interesting way of getting power from land base to the ship when it's at a dock or something like that. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and they've been around quite a few years, and they're proven very effective, and everybody uses them, and they're basically standard all over the world. So when they take their ships to these different ports and all, they can plug in. But a lot of the ships won't even do that, depending on the type of ship. They'll go on ship power and stay on ship power, but it's kind of costly in fuel, but they'll do that if the neighborhood doesn't mind the smoke coming from these babies.
Well, I would also imagine some of these big bruises you got sailing the high seas nowadays have quite a draft with them, and it must be hard to get these things near a port because of the depth required to run these things. I think a lot of cases they have like boats that ferry passengers from out where the liner is to the dock, but I guess you have to have quite a either whatever kind of ship it is have quite a bit of everything set up in your waterways, whatever, they'll handle the depth of some of these things, because I guess it could be approaching 25, 30 feet, maybe more.
Most of the ports keep a depth of about 40 feet, and of course different class ships like a carrier or a cargo carrier. I mean, we had cargo carriers that were handling Abrams tanks and Apache helicopters, and they were all modularized. They could load that ship, I would say, probably in 3 hours it'd be out to sea. And these ships are 1,000 feet long, huge, and wow, they have a top speed of something like 40 miles an hour. Incredible speed for a big ship like that. But yeah, a lot of 250-ton cranes on board, a lot of stuff on those ships. Big heavy industry stuff.
Yep. I've never been on any of these kind of ships you talk about. The only large ship I've ever been in or on, and this is going back about 30 years, I was on a Theodore Roosevelt for a couple of days doing something with the with a company I was working for at the particular time. And I came in and was docked at Norfolk, Virginia. Norfolk, Virginia. The shipyard there. And my first visit, the thing is immense. I imagine some of the ships you're talking about are probably approaching the same size of these things, especially when you look inside. These things are, astounding.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that Roosevelt was a carrier, was it not?
I didn't catch that. The carrier was what?
The Roosevelt. That was an aircraft carrier?
Yeah, that was an aircraft carrier. They didn't have any planes on the top deck. I think they had some stuff inside, but I got to walk around with the guy I was working with. He was actually from part of the Navy, some division of it, or whatever. So he knew a lot of different stuff on it. I was just like in awe and amazement looking at this stuff. Like I said, it's about 30 years ago this happened. And, I got to walk up on the top deck of the thing without any planes in. The deck is like what you don't think it is. You think it's a smooth deck or whatever. It resembles like hard sandpaper the entire, everywhere you walk up there, because I guess they want everything like skid proof or whatever. And here's an interesting thing I did find out about being on the thing. I remember going up a few decks higher, and I was looking, over the quiz of looking around or whatever, and I saw a couple of sets of Yagis pointed to the back end of the ship, and I don't know stern from aft, I don't know which one is which, but I just call it the back end of the ship, where it gets pushed from the propellers. And I asked the guy what these beams were. I think they were vertically polarized. There's about like four sets of them that I remember seeing. And he says there's something it's around 400 meg. And it was for a system to be able to bring some of the planes in remotely if the pilot got incapacitated. If it was in range of the ship, they could actually fly the thing into the ship. But it had to be within a certain range, so that's pretty cool.
Remember when they were working on that? I don't know if they ever implemented it. Evidently, they did. I saw it on a few carriers. But by the way, when a carrier comes into port, the assets are unloaded. There are no planes. They don't have enough planes to serve all of the carriers, so the fighter group that's on there and the bomber group is moved to another carrier before it comes in, and the munitions, the heavy munitions, are unloaded also.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know how many could carry what or whatever. They had just some planes inside. But I remember first as you enter this thing, you walk up from the dock and you walk into an area, like a wide open area, which is, I guess, where they normally, the maintenance area where they maintain this stuff. And all of my thought was, this thing is as big as a football field, as long as a football field, 60, 70 feet high, look like, and at least about a 200 feet wide, if not more. I said, this thing is absolutely immense.
Oh, yeah, you get some of those big carriers. It takes, when you secure them in the harbor, like here, they have five anchors, and the anchor chain, each link in that chain weighs like 80 pounds. They're huge. Yeah. Boy, oh boy. Those carriers are very big and very difficult to work on. There's so much stuff on a carrier. Where you look at, we don't have any battleships anymore, but we have cruisers and things like that. They're a little easier to get around on. A carrier's a dangerous place to be.
Well, I didn't get to see the whole place. I didn't. I got the brief 50-cent tour of what was what. There were some places that definitely couldn't go into. Couldn't go into CIC. You had to walk by the doorway, and you know, try to look inside, but you couldn't go in there, and that type of thing. But you know, I only got the brief 50-cent tour. It was a lot to take in at one time. The place I worked for was they made searchlights that went on some of these ships. So they made 30 million candle power searchlights. That's the project I was working on. That was kind of interesting all by itself. And I guess they're still in use on some of these boats.
Oh, yeah. You know, too bad you didn't get to see the CIC room. That is interesting. When you go in there and see the displays, huge displays they have, flat screens and stuff. The next time we have the home port taking place here, when the Navy comes in, they're on the west side up near Pier 90 in that area. They have some ships there. Also here in Staten Island, the home port, they berth some ships here. And you can get in to see the CIC room. Good stuff. Nice. You really love that room. Got some great equipment in it.
Yeah, I've heard about that, like, here during, I guess, ship week around approaching, like, with Memorial Day or between there and 4th of July. I think it's more like Memorial Day. They have, like, what they call a fleet week. They sell all the stuff. They don't normally bring carriers into that area. I guess they're too big to handle, correct?
They usually bring a carrier in Kennedy size, and that is only in New York. They'll have the smaller jump carriers in other places, but you want to see a big one. That is impressive. And boy, they give you a description of everything on the ship. If you talk to the guys, they'll fill you in on all that data. Maybe even give you a little guided tour, like you said, the nickel tour. They're really friendly, and but to me, they're too young. I don't know how they do it. They look like kids, and they're operating all of this billion-dollar equipment.
The time is 12:40.
I think the Kennedy was in the same class as Theodore Roosevelt. Like, you know, pretty good sized carrier. It's like 90. What did somebody call it, tell me one time? 90,000 tons of diplomacy. Yeah, W2ROI. I've been on the Intrepid, the one that's docked at the west side of Manhattan. There's not much to see there, really. There's so many places you can't go on that thing that are all blocked off. You can't go here, you can't go there. And that's an old carrier anyway, as far as size-wise. It's not really considered big. So, yeah, it was definitely like one time looking at one of these bigger ships, especially going with some, you know, something like, electronic stuff isn't CIC. That'd be neat stuff to see. I mean, I guess you can't go every single place on the ship, but, getting the 25-cent tour or so would be kind of neat. Yeah, I've been in that one already, too. I'm not sure if that is nuclear. Maybe it is. It might be one of the first nuclear ones. Maybe it is diesel. I'm not sure. I don't remember now. But it wasn't that big in size. It was nothing size-wise compared to what you have nowadays. It was pretty small. And I found it a little hard to walk through because I'm over 6 foot. So it was kind of like, duck, duck, duck every place you go. Okay, cool. I'll have to keep it in mind. It's an interesting thing that you would take in. All right, very good. The repeater's going to close down. I'll do the same thing. I'm coming in an IRLP now anyway, so I'm just sitting at the front table. Have a good one, and as it go, catch you down the log sometime. WHYY, clear with KC2, WGB.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear. auto-connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you. Bye-bye. my shotgun, I'd have a fully effective business.
Thank you. Well, I love that.